listening to It's All About Food. I hope you really enjoyed the interview we had last week as much as I did with Ian Thiesby and Henry David Firth, the authors of a new cookbook, Bosch. If you missed it, or maybe you want to hear it again, the interview is not only archived at Progressive Radio Network, but we have the video of the interview as well, archived at responsibleeatingandliving.com, so you can see these guys in action. They're really, really fun. I hope you'll check that out. responsibleeatingandliving.com, that's where the archived video is. Now, last week when I had these guys on the show, we talked the entire hour, and I didn't get a chance to really talk about my recent trip to Costa Rica. So that's how I want to start the show today. Now, when in Costa Rica with my partner Gary, we ate just like we eat all the time. We weren't on a fast or anything. We were there to have food. And we had some challenges and some delights. So I wanted to talk about some of that right now. The first part of the trip, we stayed in a place called Playa Hermosa, which is in the northern part of Costa Rica, kind of like in a peninsula. And when we first got there, it was late in the afternoon, and we were really hungry. So we went to the restaurant at the resort. And one of the things I love about a lot of the structures in a tropical paradise like Costa Rica is many of the restaurants and some of the homes actually have these spaces that are covered with roofs, but they're open to the outdoors. So this restaurant was all open to the outdoors. It had a roof, but everything was open. And we sat near the edge that overlooked a hill. And as we were sitting there, we heard and saw the howler monkeys. Now, I have heard them while staying in Costa Rica. Usually when you wake up in the morning and you're kind of out in the woodsy area, the tropical areas, the jungle areas, you'll hear them. They have a howling, unusual sound. And they'll wake you up. But I never saw them this close, swinging in the trees. It was really so, so lovely. And we didn't know what kind of food they would have, but they sure enough had beans and rice and guacamole and salad. So we did fine. In fact, that's pretty much what we ate all week. So the next day, once we had settled in, we walked to a local grocery store. I had looked online to be prepared when I got there because I knew the resort really wasn't in a town that was well populated. But there was this store nearby, so we walked to it. I was a little disappointed when we got there because the produce section was on the small side. And I have delighted many times in different stores in Costa Rica, grocery stores, at all the wonderful different kinds of produce. So this was a little disappointing, but we picked up the things that we needed. And I'm surprised, I want to say pleasantly surprised and disappointed at the same time. Is that possible? I see so much American influence on this country. Some of it's good, some of it's not so good. So in terms of food, we were able to get rolled oats, and they had plenty of different kinds of beans that are grown in the country, black beans, garbanzo beans, lentils. We couldn't find any brown rice, so we bought some white rice, and we picked up papaya, pineapple, mangoes, avocado. We can get those at home, too, but these were all locally grown. We also got some potatoes and onions, garlic, that sort of thing. But some of the things that they had there that really surprised me, they had organic tahini. They had nori for making sushi or maki. What else did they have? Oh, they had soy milk. they had a bunch of different kinds of plant milks. They were expensive, really expensive, but they were there. So you could really see the influence of the tourists in this particular area on what is sold. And once we got our stuff, we walked back and we were able to make some pretty nice meals during our stay at this particular resort. Fortunately, Gary had brought several packages of raisins from Trader Joe's, and this was a good thing because the raisins that we found weren't very good. Okay, this isn't a place you go to for raisins. This is a place you go to for tropical fruits, and I had plenty of them. After a very relaxing week being on the beach and by the pool and enjoying the warm weather, it was really, really wonderful. We stopped by the next town, Playa del Coco, before we left to head to our next destination. And Playa del Coco is a little more populated. There were many more restaurants and stores. And we stopped into one grocery store and were really amazed. Not only did they have a huge selection of plant milks, they had vegan cheese, all of the popular American brands, Daya, Follow Your Heart. And then in the frozen food section, they had the Daya cheesecakes, the vegan cheesecakes. I've never had one. And I've never really wanted to buy one because if I wanted to make a vegan cheesecake, I would make one myself. But we were thinking my birthday was coming up and that would make a wonderful birthday cake. But we didn't buy one because we were going on a long drive and we didn't have anything to keep it frozen. And I was thinking, well, if they have it in the store here, maybe we'll have it in some of the grocery stores where we're going. So we didn't try it. We didn't get it. And sure enough, when we got to our next destination near San Isidro in the more southern part of Costa Rica, we didn't find it in the stores that we went into. So we stayed in San Isidro for a night with my friend Beth, and we went to dinner pretty late. It was around 9 o'clock after she had taught an acro yoga class that I participated in. And we went to this place called Todos Tapas. And they were telling us about the owner chef who was from Spain. And he opened up this restaurant. And we had a really lovely time, but it was kind of frustrating because in the 14 years that I've been visiting Costa Rica, I've noticed that the nicer restaurants in this particular area, San Isidro, don't do very well. They don't last. And when I say nice, I'm not talking about really upscale, just a pleasant place, not fast food, where the food is prepared relatively fresh. And this was one of these places, and you could tell that the chef owner put some thought into the restaurant. It's kind of a retro place where you get to hear music from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and see some of the videos that go along with it. It was fun. And the menu was really eclectic with really very limited options for vegans. What was sad was we were the only ones in the restaurant. So the chef made Gary and I some gorgeous green salads. I don't even think they were on the menu, but he made them for us. And then we had a potato dish that had a tomato-y kind of sauce on it that had some really lovely spices. The food was really quite good and very fresh. I remember another restaurant that I had really enjoyed there. It was simple food and vegetarian. And sure enough, it's not there anymore. It was in business and then out of business. And I think it's because it's a confusing kind of economy. that has not found balance yet. So there are the locals who don't make very much money, the ones that work on the farms. And in some of the city jobs, they don't make a lot of money. So if you've got a restaurant that's charging prices that are almost comparable to some restaurants in the United States, they're not affordable. They're only affordable to tourists or the expatriates who are living in Costa Rica on their retirement benefits and savings. And that's probably why these restaurants don't last very long. Then again, our last night in San Ysidro, when we left San Ysidro to stay on a farm for a few days and then we came back, we stayed in another place that was very popular. But they served more traditional foods there, and maybe that's just what everybody wants. I don't have all the answers. So after San Ysidro, we went to a town about 40-minute drive away, and it's only that long because the roads aren't all paved, so you can't go very fast on these rocky roads. And I actually bought property near this area, and my friend Beth lives there. She has a farm with her family, and we stayed there a few days. And what was wonderful about it is they have been growing a lot of their own food, and they figured out how to grow certain foods that aren't naturally grown there, like kale. And you might want to visit my blog. You can see on my birthday, day 1167, some wonderful videos, especially the one in the garden with all of the kale. I can't believe how they do this, but there's just plants and plants and plants and plants of kale. I don't know about you, but when I see food growing, either fruits growing from a tree or plants growing in a garden, I get very excited. It's so much better to get your food right out of the ground or right off the tree. It's like in my DNA. That's the way it's supposed to be. And after I picked all of this fantastic fresh kale, I made the best kale salad I think I've ever eaten. And when it was time for celebrating my birthday, Beth wanted to make me a birthday cake. And I have to confess, I've never had this kind of cake before. They kind of created it on the fly. Gary helped her. She used something called cuadrado bananas. They're like square looking bananas, and they tend to be exceptionally starchy, so they can be used instead of flour. And they made this interesting kind of cake, and I was very happy to have it. Our last night in Costa Rica, we spent at a classic hotel, and Gary was very happy to be there. He had endured almost 10 days exposed to all kinds of bugs and bats and iguana and pasote and just all kinds of different things we'd never seen before. It was really delightful. And then we were in this hotel and explaining to them that we were vegan. They were very, very helpful. And when they brought out the dish that we had ordered, which was basically grilled vegetables, they seemed very proud of themselves and said, we've never prepared this before. And they brought it out on a beautiful platter. It was really quite stunning and very, very delicious. So we ate okay in Costa Rica. Now, the next thing I want to cover is the Food Revolution Summit. So how many of you participated in the Food Revolution Summit? It just ended this past weekend. It was a 9-day event. It was the 7th annual Food Revolution Summit, and I think it was the best ever. Were you there? Did you hear some of it, all of it? I actually learned a few things, which is always exciting for me. But the most interesting is reading all the questions that people post during the summit. So there were three interviews every day where John Robbins would interview a different expert in the food revolution, in the food movement. And his son, Ocean Robbins, is the MC of this event, and he would introduce everyone and then answer questions in between the interviews. And I was working behind the scenes answering questions as people would post them on the broadcast page. And I always like to review the questions that they ask every year. Some of them are the same every year, and then there are some new ones. So what were some of the new ones this year? People seem to be focused a lot on ketogenic diets, and often they were asking, what do you think of ketogenic diets? What do the authors think? And what do you think? Are you interested in a ketogenic diet? I'll tell you what I think. I think it's just another trend. And people look for trends, and people look for opportunities to eat some of the foods that they like and want to think that they're healthy. Now, a ketogenic diet has been very helpful for treating children with epilepsy. It's a diet that consists of lots of fat, little or no carbohydrates, and a moderate amount of protein. And many people now are focusing on this kind of diet, saying that it's healthy and that it's health promoting and can reduce risk of disease and promote longevity. The truth is that there really have not been any long-term studies to prove that this is true. And from all of the best evidence that we have so far involving nutrition, from either specific scientific studies of foods in general or by evaluating different populations around the world and what they eat, the experts agree that the kind of diet we should be eating is not a ketogenic diet, but a whole food, minimally processed plant diet. So many people at the summit get confused about this because they've heard lots of different things, and from some of the speakers too, they hear some things that are confusing to them, and I don't blame them. But the one thing that I like that Dr. David Katz stressed was what I just told you, that most people today agree that whole food, minimally processed, plant-based diet is the best to our current knowledge. Now, we can decide what plant-based means because it's really not clear. Plant-based does not mean vegan. And vegan doesn't always mean healthy. That's why people like Dr. T. Colin Campbell uses a whole food plant-based diet, and he means a whole food all-plant diet. But vegan can include processed foods and junk foods. It can just be Coca-Cola and chips. That's not a healthy diet, but it's vegan. So we have to be really specific when we're talking about what's really healthy. And a lot of people have jumped on the plant-based bandwagon without defining what plant-based is. I read a lot of different programs recommending different kinds of diets, and many of them use the term plant-based, and then when I see what their recipes consist of and what their diet consists of, it's not as rich in plants as I would like to see. So this term is really loose. But everyone is agreeing that processed foods, junk foods, a lot of animal foods, and restaurant foods that are made with lots of oil and sugar and salt are not health promoting. Okay, we can agree on something. But still, when people are listening to all of these different experts in the summit, they can get confused. Dr. Neil Barnard was at the summit, and he talked about his book, The Cheese Trap, and he talked a bit about dairy as well. We had Dr. Neil Barnard on this program when his book, The Cheese Trap, came out. For many people at the summit, a lot of this information was new, and hearing about how cheese is really not health-promoting and how it's addictive was mind-blowing, to the point where they were asking questions about dairy and trying to figure out, is there any kind of animal milk that they can consume that's okay? They were asking, is it okay to have goat's milk or sheep's milk or cheese from goats and cheese? And what about yogurt? All these foods that they had heard over the years or learned over the years through their culture or through their education that they thought was healthy. All of a sudden, this one doctor is giving all kinds of evidence about why it isn't and why not only cow's milk and cow's milk products should be avoided, but other animal milk as well. So I was sharing with a lot of people information about the plant-based yogurts, because yogurt can be helpful with the probiotics it contains. And a lot of people realize that yogurt is something good to have. Many people have digestive problems today. That's a whole nother topic. And they want to have their yogurt. And we make yogurt with soy milk, with coconut milk, with cashew milk, with almond milk. There were also lots of people asking about bone broth. Are you consuming bone broth? Has anyone told you that this is a good thing to have? The interesting thing about bone broth is there really aren't any studies about it. There aren't any studies that show that it's a health-promoting, nutritious food. Now, there may be some good things in bone broth, but there's nothing in there that can really be better than a rich vegetable broth. A vegetable broth that's full of minerals from plant foods and fiber from plant foods, which you cannot get from animal foods. Fiber comes from plants, and fiber is probably the one nutrient people don't get enough of, because we need to be eating more plants. So I always have a bone to pick when people talk about bone broth, because it's being pushed down people's throats. And why don't we just push plants? Well, that's what I do. I'm a plant pusher. There were, of course, the same believers in the myths of soy being a dangerous food to eat, the myth of canola oil being a bad oil to consume, the myth that we need to combine certain plant foods with other foods to make complete protein, and the myth of food combining where we're not supposed to eat fruits with vegetables. I don't even know the rules, but none of it is based on science. So let me back up a little bit. People have heard from some of their doctors that soy isn't a healthy food to eat if you have breast cancer, or soy shouldn't be eaten for one reason or another. And I hope you know from this show and from other programs that minimally processed organic soy foods are health promoting and can be part of a healthy diet. Now, if you have an allergy to soy, there are many foods in the plant kingdom you don't have to eat soy foods, but soy foods can be part of a healthy diet. I'm talking about soy milk, edamame, tempeh, tofu, miso. These are the minimally processed soy foods that are yummy and nutritious. Now, what was the next thing I mentioned? The myth of canola oil. Organic canola oil can be part of a healthy diet. I'm not pushing oil because I don't think we should be using a lot of oil. Oil is a processed food. It has no fiber. It's all fat. It has a lot of calories. But if you want to cook with oil, organic canola oil is an okay choice. It's not the same as conventional canola. Conventional canola is GMO and grown with a lot of pesticides and herbicides, Roundup, and is not a good choice. With regard to making a complete protein, all plant foods, repeat after me, all plant foods have complete protein. They contain all the essential amino acids that we need, the amino acids that we cannot make in our own bodies that we need to build protein. We do not need to combine beans and rice or other foods to make complete protein. All plant foods have complete protein, and as long as we eat a varied diet, our body will get what it needs, and it will know where to get what it needs when it needs it. We don't have to consume certain foods in the same meal. Our bodies are smarter than that. But unfortunately, people hear the promotion of these myths over and over again from people who sound like they know what they're talking about. Then there were lots of questions about flax seeds and chia seeds. So flax seeds and chia seeds, you may know, are rich in omega-3 fatty acids. They're very important to consume. And people were asking, is it better to have flax oil or flax seeds or flax meal? Do you know the answer? It's best to buy the flax seed whole and then grind it yourself. So if you buy flax meal, you don't know when it was ground, you don't know how it was stored, and it may actually be rancid or it may be degrading to a point where it's not as nutritious for you to eat and may actually not be good to eat. So if you buy the flaxseed whole, the flaxseed will stay fresh forever. They say about a couple of years, but I think the seed actually, if stored in a cool, dry place, will last a very, very long time. Once you grind it, then it needs to be kept very cool and consumed quickly. I like to keep my ground flax seeds in the freezer, and I use them almost every day. Now, some people say that ground flax seeds will only last a couple of weeks. I've read in several places that they will last 2 to 3 months. I know what rancid flax seeds taste like, and I've kept mine in the freezer for a couple of months, and they still taste quite fresh. So the freezer is a good place to keep your freshly ground flax seeds. But what I also heard at the Food Revolution Summit was that chia seeds need to be ground as well. And this was news for me. I didn't know that chia seeds had to be ground, but the research shows that ground chia seeds are more absorbable than if they are not ground. So I'll be grinding them from now on. If you missed the Food Revolution Summit, I highly recommend that you go to foodrevolutionsummit.org and try and catch some of the replays, which will be broadcast over the next few weeks. For the second part of the show today, I have pre-recorded an interview with Robert Grillo. So here we go. All right, my guest is Robert Grillo. He's an activist, author, and speaker. He is the director of Free From Harm, which he founded in 2009 to expose animal agriculture's impact on non-human animals, vulnerable communities, and the environment. As a marketing communications professional for over 20 years, Grillo has worked on large food industry accounts through which he acquired a behind-the-scenes perspective on food branding and marketing. Farm to Fable is his first book. We spoke about that a couple of years ago when it just came out, and he lives in Chicago. Robert, it's nice to be able to talk to you today.
great to be with you again, too.
Okay, you've been very busy. So why don't you give me a little update on what Free From Harm has been up to, and then we'll talk about what's really been going on most recently, which is very exciting.
Sure, yeah, I'd love to. So some of the recent projects that I'm working on and people at Free From Harm are working on, one exciting project is something we call, it's a series of profiles of former animal farmers that are now either sanctuary people that have converted, transitioned their farm from to a sanctuary, or they're somehow involved in animal rights, or they're now in the business of selling vegan products. Like there's a couple that are vegan cheese makers now that used to be.
Yeah. That's exciting. So
we have 18 profiles to start with, and we're going to launch this microsite. It's really kind of within the Free From Harm domain, but it'll be kind of its own place. And we will also be using other domains to attract farmers. And so there's two kinds of audiences for this site. It's first, it's people like you and I that are looking for really transformational stories that we want to share with people, because these are very powerful stories of transformation. But then the other audience that we're hoping to capture is the many farmers that every time we do one of these profiles, the person, one of the questions we ask is, do you know farmers that, like yourself, that you've had conversations with about animal farming? And do they express doubts? Do they express an interest in making a transition like you did? Do you inspire them? And inevitably, almost everyone who's asked the question says, I know a lot of people who they would like to make a change. They don't feel good about certain things when it comes to their profession. And there's a lot of things that are quite frankly not very fruitful for them either when it comes to this. It's amazing how many people there could potentially be out there that might say, hey, this site might help me make that transition. So we hope to also have a page that's like about resources for farmers and how they might do it practically and economically to make a transition like that.
I love it. It's fantastic. I know a lot of farmers struggle, and we read a lot, especially in those that raise chickens and that have contracts with Tyson and the other big chicken farm corporations.
Right.
They take out big mortgages. They have to follow all the regulations. And it's a funny thing because the whole industry is like vertically integrated. Tyson owns just about everything. They own the birds and they own the way things are done. And they may or may not buy so many chickens back from the people that are raising it. But the people that are raising it, they have the big mortgage, they have the big expense, and sometimes they're just barely making it.
Right. Yeah, it certainly seems to be the case. And, you know, you look at the people who take these jobs and farm workers and slaughterhouses, and you realize that they really are, in many cases, the jobs of last resort.
Yep. You know? This is very exciting because I can imagine those who have had the courage and have made a transition can really be inspirational to others, some food for thought for others. And is it up yet, or you're just building it?
Our content is currently up, but it's not going to, the new site, the way it's going to be presented is not up yet. We're still working on putting finishing touches on it. We profile in the series is Brenda Vetter, and she's living outside of Madison. It was really great because when I was doing this story on pheasant hunting in Wisconsin, it turns out I was looking for someone that had rescued pheasants because I wanted to tell that side of the story. Researching the whole canned hunting story there, I really wanted to get the perspective of someone who actually got to know pheasants as individuals and has them on their sanctuary. So that worked out so beautifully. So yeah, I worked on that pheasant story and I got it published on Alternet, and we're hoping that some of their affiliate media outlets might be interested in the story. We're really kind of hoping, because it's a pretty astonishing story. When you consider the fact, if you don't mind me transitioning to this.
No, this is the focus of the show. So we want to know more about this whole story. What is the pheasant story?
It's even something bigger than just about pheasants. But I decided that what caught my eye was a story in the Wisconsin State Journal that said that the state has invested $1.7 million in a pheasant hatchery, the Department of Natural Resources. And I didn't know. I mean, I don't know everything, but I'm pretty tuned into what's going on in animal agriculture. And I have never yet heard of a pheasant hatchery that's a factory that produces thousands of pheasant chicks each day. And I thought, this is just surreal and so disturbing.
So that people can hunt them.
Exactly. So what I found in doing this story and talking to the DNR people that run this hatchery, and the, you know, what they do is they sell these chicks to the game farms, which are canned hunting farms throughout the state. What I learned from these people and trying to have a sane conversation with them is that there's a narrative there that's very important to winning the public's trust about this. Because the 85% of the public I discovered don't hunt. It's just the 15% in Wisconsin that hunt. But the 85% begrudgingly accept hunting because they buy into this narrative, which is based on fear-mongering, that animals will take over the earth, that they will take over their communities, right? But here's what's so ironic about the situation. These are pheasants that are being mass-produced. They're considered an invasive species. They take over habitat of the indigenous species that the DNR is supposed to be protecting. So here they are introducing thousands of lives into, instead of controlling populations, because, you know, the narrative of hunting is conservation, controlling populations. They're actually countering that by what they do. They're actually bringing all these thousands of birds into this world just to be shot at. I kind of questioned them about this, and what I learned is they don't have a response. Their response is that pheasant hunting and the money that generates as a blood sport, as a recreational activity, 40% of that goes back into what they call wildlife or habitat restoration to save other species. Think about that. The logic of that is
it's money. It doesn't make it. There's no logic. And, it's just the way it's always been.
And our tax dollars, we have that in Illinois too, and our tax dollars are paying for it. So I figured one way to kind of get their attention is maybe to launch a campaign to get people to contact their elected officials and say, we don't want our tax dollars being spent on these awful hatcheries. So that would be one way we could put a dent. So that's kind of one project I've been working on as well.
I'm just so mind-boggled. It's just so nutty, unbelievable. And if they're supposed to be an invasive species, why are we breeding them?
They displace the habitat of other wild birds and animals. And I have to tell you, looking at the videos from some of the hunters, you know, the championships that they have in Wisconsin and Minnesota, they're training these children to be vicious against these birds. I mean, they're so tame because they've been raised in captivity that if you run up to them, that they'll be frozen stiff. They won't even move. What they're doing is to get them to fly, they'll either pick them up and throw them into the air, or they'll kick them into the air, and then they'll just shoot them at a range of 10 to 20 feet and think that that's some kind of sport. It's the most vicious thing it's one of the worst things I've ever seen. I couldn't believe it. So I had to write a story about it.
We live in a society that exploits everything. Yeah. And we exploit nature, we exploit animals, we exploit each other.
Right.
It's human nature. And there is a group, I want to think that it's growing, that is starting to say, no, humans don't want to do this anymore. And I'm really hopeful that we're evolving, perhaps. And this is just one tiny, unfortunate thing that's happening in the whole grand scheme of things. So
right.
let's connect the dots like you did. How are you, your bigger picture is with guns and hunting, right? Because guns, yeah. Everybody's talking about them now, gun rights.
Yeah.
And because we've had so many unfortunate instances in the schools and in public places with these random killings. Yeah, so let's talk about that.
Yeah, I'd love that. One of the things that I opened with in the Besant story was the fact that I heard Jimmy Carter, I don't know how he got into the news cycle, but he suddenly was in the news cycle and he's being interviewed and he doesn't have a book out or anything that I'm aware of. But all of a sudden he's back in and his message was that the current effort to pass gun laws isn't about hunting or people that use their guns in self-defense. And I had to let that sink in, because what it really kind of said to me was, I wonder if he did this to Burton or not, but he was kind of making a moral equivalence there between killing in self-defense and hunting for killing animals for sport. And I thought, wow, even the most liberal, some of the more liberal voices in our culture are legitimizing killing animals for sport. And so that really got me thinking how we're really not making the connection between different forms of violence in our culture, and how that it's a known fact that many of these mass shooters have a history of harming animals and then moving on to the human victims, right? We know that, and yet we've got liberal politicians and the media who honor hunting. They honor the killing of other species, but they mourn the loss of our own kind. And it's such an incredible disparity to see. So we're chipping away at that. We're trying to change that conversation.
The whole notion of hunting for many people has a romantic feeling to it for them. Yeah. It brings up all kinds of stereotypical images of strong men that go out into the natural woods, yeah, and bring back the game for the family.
Right.
But you even talked about how there are a lot of women too that are getting into this sport, because, you know, the women want to have equal footing with men. So we're going to sign up and do all the awful things that the men are doing, which is kind of nutty.
It sure is.
We're continually working on society and changing what is acceptable and what is normal.
Yeah.
There's a lot of conversation today about rape, and we have the Me Too movement and all the things that we're not accepting anymore that people used to be very hush-hush about. We're having a lot of loud conversations, and that's good. And it's true, too, with exploiting non-human species.
Yeah, for sure. I hope that, we have so much work to do, I feel, at some points. But then I also see signs that are very positive. Like today I learned about a settlement that Smithfield had to pay to these communities, surrounding communities, a 50 million plus settlement. And that's like a precedent. I guess that it's kind of a precedent, and it really scares the industry, because they've been able to kind of push back on these legal challenges before. And now maybe the fact that they're not so powerful doing that, maybe that's a sign of the times.
What was the settlement for?
The settlement had something to do with communities filed a class action lawsuit against Smithfield for polluting waterways, for mismanaging all the manure that they produce, and creating a public nuisance, as I understand it. But they haven't been very successful, these kinds of lawsuits, in the past. But maybe it's a sign of the times that's changing. Let's hope so.
Absolutely. These companies are not just exploiting non-human animals. They're exploiting human animals as well. The workers are treated very poorly in many instances, from raising the animals to slaughtering the animals and then to packing and shipping. These folks don't make a lot of money and they're not treated well. And then there's the environment. And if they can get away with dumping shit in our waterways, literally, they'll do it. Yeah. And we've just been letting it happen. But not anymore, not with free from harm.
That's right.
So So when did the article in Alternate come out?
About a week ago.
And what's been the response so far?
Pretty good. They told me that they have a lot of affiliate media outlets too that might take an interest in this, like Bill Moyers and Huffington Post and some other. So maybe it'll get some secondary leverage with some other media outlets, I'm hoping. Because it starts out really talking about gun violence in general, and then how this hatchery thing caught my eye, and I go into the pheasant hunting. But yeah, we'll see. I hope so. Another project I just finished is a manuscript for an anthology, and it's called Meatsplaining.
What is it called?
Well, you've heard of mansplaining.
Yes.
And this is called Meatsplaining.
I like it. Meatsplaining. Yeah. Oh, how many times have we heard Meatsplaining?
Meatsplaining, yes. So it's several authors, and they asked me for a contribution. I just finished that. It's about 5,500 words, and it's kind of a critique of, there's a new documentary coming out called Cow versus Kale, The Case for Better Meat.
Ooh.
By a woman named Diana Rogers, who has a pasture-raised ranch. She's a rancher. And pasture-raised rancher. In a way, the narrative is very similar to Food Inc. and Joel Salatin and yep. Michael Pollan. Yep. But it could be the next big film about that whole better meat narrative. So I thought it was a good opportunity to pick, deconstruct that and look at the different messages and look at that kind of from a critical light without like targeting her, because I didn't want it to feel like a piece that was just about looking at her, but it's more so just the whole movement that she embodies in this movie. So that was, you know, this whole idea that we can raise animals sustainably and humanely, it's just something that we're gonna have to confront and challenge more and more. It's just it's really one of the big cultural narratives of our time.
It is very big, and although raising animals humanely, it's not humane, but raising animals where they're allowed to graze, breathe the air, and be around their family and friends until it's time to like slaughter them is gaining popularity. And there's a lot of problems with it. We all acknowledge it's better than factory farming. Hey, factory farming is horrible. So it's like, how many levels of horrible do you have? So it's horrible, but it's not as horrible as factory farming.
Right.
And we have to acknowledge that we can't raise enough animals for meat with the current demand of meat that is increasing in China and India. Maybe it's going down a little bit in the United States. I don't know. But we can't raise animals for meat unless we condense them in factory farms. So if we're going to move to this sustainable type of farming, everybody's still going to have to reduce their meat consumption, which nobody wants to acknowledge. But I've also heard that we've lost a lot of people who were moving towards vegetarianism and veganism because of this humane farming, because people really still want to eat their meat and they're feeling less guilty somehow. So this is big.
Yeah.
It's kind of a way to shove under the rug the reality of what's really going on.
Well, and they have us believing too that the comparison is really between better meat, the so-called better meat, and factory farming. Mm-hmm. When you look at it, that's really a false dilemma. Because one of the things that came out of this project was that I did a lot of research into veganic agriculture, and I talked to some people that are doing some amazing stuff. One woman named Helen Atho. She's got her own organic vegan farm, but she also has done a lot of research and testing. It's very interesting how she approaches this very methodically. Learned a lot in the process. If the better meat people really wanted to do an apples to apples comparison, because their objectives were really about soil sequestration and regenerating the land and mitigating climate gases and all this stuff, if those are their goals, then they're a better comparison. It wouldn't be factory farming, it would be veganic farming, because veganic farming is organic agriculture without the animal inputs, without the blood meal and feather meal and manure, because none of those things are actually necessary when you have green manure. Plant matter that actually, you know, according to Helen Atho, creates a much more sustained, like slow, she calls it a slow release, whereas manure is just like a shot of sugar. to the bloodstream. Yeah, it's a better system, and it doesn't create all the run-up and pollution and pathogens that end up in romaine lettuce.
A couple of things. When people say that it's beneficial for the land and the soil to have animals on the land and soil, which is their explanation for why it's good to farm these animals, I say, okay, you want to have animals on your farm? Fine. Why do you have to kill them?
Right.
If you want them trampling and walking around, fine. The other interesting thing about veganic agriculture is that in Europe, it started because people didn't have animals on their farms and they needed to develop a way to grow food without manure.
Yeah.
And they did. And
right.
There's a handful of people that are using human manure. That's another story.
Yeah, sure is.
What are you going to do with all this poop? You got to compost it.
Exactly. Well, you know, in organic farming is very much, it's all about manure, using animals, because that's how they justify the exploitation of animals, because they say it's based on a necessity argument. But what I learned is that it's false. It really isn't necessary. And look at what it's created. Look at the romaine lettuce outbreak here. There's nothing in the media about the fact that this can only originate from some kind of animal in source. It has to come from the manure or something from an animal in order to then contaminate. It has to come from that source. It has to come from the animal agriculture.
You get so much press when vegetables are involved.
Yeah.
And like you said, nobody talks about why it happened. It comes from animal manure that was used as fertilizer on these plants, and most of that manure came from factory farms where the animals are mistreated and they live in filth and they encourage all of that disease.
And they're spraying the field with manure. I mean, there's nowhere else to put it, so they're using it as fertilizer because these factory farms have nowhere else to, what are they going to do, store it in lagoons for until it dries out? I mean, they have to find a use for it.
Yeah, think of like whey protein, for example. I mean, there is another example of like, they didn't know what to do with all this whey protein they got from separating it from the milk. So they came up with, oh yeah, let's make protein powder out of it and tell the athletes they really need it.
Designer premium protein, which is really a waste product from the yogurt making industry.
Yep. Oh, please. Robert, save the world for us. Okay. So is there anything else you want to tell me about the pheasant or the Wisconsin tax dollars or anything else on that subject? Can people sign a petition or something?
Yeah. The AltraNet article has a petition at the end of it. It would be great if we could get as many signatures as possible.
Okay, great. I'll include a link to the article on this podcast. Great.
And tomorrow is International Respect for Chickens Day. And so United Poultry Concerns, run by Karen Davis, has asked activists and other people to do some kind of action or something to build awareness about chickens. I'm going to do a Facebook live stream video and talk about some of our rescues. But then on Sunday, we're with Chicago Animal Safe. Free From Harm is going to participate in a rally near a slaughterhouse in Chicago. And we're going to do speakouts, and we're going to congregate, and we might actually occupy the space in the slaughterhouse for a while if we can do so, and hopefully get some public and media attention and outreach.
Exciting. Excellent. So what's the name of the day that it is?
International Respect for Chickens.
International Respect for Chickens. Now, is that every May 4th or is it?
To my understanding, it is. And it's something that I believe Karen Davis came up with. So for me, it's about, of course, honoring the chickens, but it's also about partly honoring Karen Davis because for 30 plus years now, she's been such a tireless advocate. And I've learned so much from her about everything. So it's a nice way to tribute her too.
I love that. And she deserves it. Like you said, she's worked so tirelessly and has done so much amazing stuff. And, you know, the Me Too movement has also hit the animal rights movement, the vegan movement, Me Too.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think Karen has been treated well enough in this world as she deserves because she's a woman. And I'll just put it there like that.
Yeah, you're probably right.
I'm just thinking of a specific event that happened at the 2002 Animal Rights Movement Farm event.
Uh-huh.
There are stories online about what happened.
I think I know what you might be referring to.
Okay, I've started it, so I'm just going to say it briefly and then we can just tie this up. Howard Lyman was the MC, and he introduced some actress who was relatively new in the movement as the shape of the movement. And we didn't really respond very well to it. And then he said it again because he didn't get the laugh that he wanted. And then later on in the same ceremony, he introduced another woman actress, blonde, attractive, young, as the shape of the movement. And I remember Karen Davis being there, and I think she might, I don't know if she was part of the ceremony or whatever, but she just didn't get the same introduction because she wasn't young and blonde.
Right.
She had done so much incredible work. It was just very frustrating at that moment and in other moments as well, that we don't give the people who do the great work what they deserve. So I like that May 4th is International Respect for Chickens, and also sending out love to Karen Davis.
Exactly. Yeah. And she's still, you know, she's still going so strong, you know.
Yep.
She's still as strong as ever. I'm going to see her at the Animal Rights Conference in LA at the end of June. So, you know, we'll have a drink at the bar and like we usually do. And kind of, it's a little bit of a reunion. We get to chit-chat, and it's nice to see her. It really is.
Okay, well, Robert, thank you for sharing all of this good stuff. It's so inspiring to hear what you're doing.
Well, thank you for having me. I love being on your show. I love what you're doing. And I follow you on Facebook. That's about the extent of, you know, I listen to your show, and I follow you on Facebook. And I love, you know, the range of things and topics that you cover is really wonderful.
Thank you. Well, you know, to stay healthy, I don't just focus on vegan activism.
Yeah.
You know, and that's important, I think, for all of us to nourish ourselves and rejuvenate ourselves, because there is more to life than this, even though this is my life and it's very important, but it can be very frustrating and we have to keep things light and humorous. I don't know if you saw, I was just in Costa Rica celebrating my 60th birthday.
That's terrific.
Yep, a lot of fun birds out there too.
Yeah.
Birds and bats and bugs.
Oh, cool. I love them.
Okay, Robert, thank you for joining me so much on It's All About Food.
Thank you so much, Karen. Have a great one.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's the end of our show for today. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. You can find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Send me an email with comments and questions at info@realmeals.org. And everybody, please have a delicious week.